Hi guys, welcome to our exam one review session. Here I'm going to, well, I'll show you that slide in a bit, but I'm going to review a lot of the concepts and material that was in lecture and such, in hopes of jogging your memory and, you know, sort of guiding you towards, you know, maybe if you've forgotten some of the things that you might want to look over, and things like that. So, a few reminders. The exam is this Monday. Scary. Hopefully not too much, but it's for, I guess, you guys who are here and the local students. It's in place of lecture, so it'll be from 5:30 to 7:30 at Harvard Hall 104. And then for those joining us online and such, the distance students, hopefully you've already gotten your remote proctoring all sorted out. We sent an email about that last month, so hopefully that's all good. And then, you know, for those distance, if you have questions, there's where to go to find out more about remote proctoring, which you hopefully have already done. And then it'll be 2 hours, because lecture is usually 2 hours, so no exam will be 2 hours. It's closed book, so no notes, no, you know, handheld devices, no laptops. It's pretty much you and paper, or paper and writing utensil, and you, and your knowledge. Okay, so there was a question about the length of the exam, how the practice exam says, practice exam from several years ago, I think it says like you have 60 minutes or so, and now we have 2 hours. It's sort of hard to gauge how long it'll take people, because, you know, some students like think more than others, I suppose, or such. But it should be, like, judging from past years, it should be the same length in terms of material or pages. Yay. Oh. Cool, so moving on, a few study tips that I think might be helpful if you were looking for some. Know the stuff in lectures. If they mention something, if they talk about something, definitely like know that, even if it's possibly obscure, or, you know, or if they devote like a minute to it. Please do know the lecture material, because that's where I suspect most, if not all, the exam material will draw from. So, you know, to do this, you can look over the slides, the topics. You know, would you be able to explain these things to someone? Or you can pick a lecture that Dan or David talks about and think about whether you could explain it to someone. Yay! And then, if you have time, you can rewatch or skim the videos. Also, do try the practice exam. If nothing else, it'll sort of give you an idea of the format. And then also an idea of maybe the iffier areas that you're not quite sure about. And then if you want even more detail, or if, say, Dan or David mentioned something and you want to know more about it, you want to study it, then readings and sections would be helpful for, like, the details, maybe having it explained in a different way. And then you could also use the internet, say, like, Google a source, or, like, Wikipedia, and then find information that way. But do be careful which site you look at, because, you know, like, almost anyone can put anything on the internet. So, like, Wikipedia is more or less, you know, they require that the people who put information on there have citations. Also, I think it's called the Course Wiki? That's also a good place to, you know, go for information. Yay! You guys can do it! You guys can study well. Cool, so here's our ambitious agenda, more or less. Here's the sort of like the route or the path that I'm going to, that my slides are going to take. It's going to go from like top to bottom and left to right. There we go. Yay. So let's talk about binary, the basics of binary. So it's base 2 number system. What we normally use in our everyday lives is base 10. I'll get to that in a little bit, where the digits are from 0 to 9. So a base 2 number system is one in which each digit is a power of 2. Like in our decimal system, each digit is a power of 10, right? 10 to the 1, 10 to the 2. In binary, you have, you know, 2 to the 0, 2 to the 1. And each binary digit is called a bit. And, yeah, just a bit of terminology. And a bit can either be a 1 or a 0. Can't be a 2, as we know it, you know, the curved number 2. Can't be like a 9 or whatever. Can't be ABC or whatever. It's 1 or 0. And it you can sort of think of that as corresponding with on or off, or true or false, when we later get into hardware that might help. And an analogy for a bit being 0 or 1, corresponding with on or off, true or false, could be sort of like using a flashlight or switches that only have like two states, on or off, up or down, I guess, to represent data. I'll go more into this when I start talking about hardware, but I guess you can just keep that in the back of your mind for now. And then, why do we care about binary? Like, why base 2, you know, who cares about this? Well, it's the language of computers. It's sort of what computers think, quote unquote, if you want to think about it that way, or how they execute things. I'll go more into that when I talk about hardware, which is after binary and this. Yay, well, I guess binary is part of hardware. But anyway, so let's talk about how to go to binary from decimal. So say in decimal, you have the number 42, because that's the answer to the universe and all that stuff, right? Anyway, little joke there, but let's say in decimal you have the number 42. Normally, you would represent that, as you learned back in grade school, I want to say, or back in the day, you'd represent that with a 4 and a 2, i.e. a 4 in the tens column, a 2 in the ones column, and then you would add up those powers of 10. So in decimal, each digit or each place is a power of 10. You know, you have your ones, your tens, your hundreds, your thousands, and then you just sort of add up those columns. So similarly, in binary, if you wanted to represent 42, well, instead of having, you know, columns of tens, we have columns of twos. So you have your ones, your twos, your fours, your eights, 16, you know, powers of two. And if you wanted to represent 42, how you would go about doing this is, well, first, so 42. What makes 42? How would you break it up into binary digits? Is there, going off of this example, the first question you might want to ask yourself is, does 64 fit into 42? The answer is no, it does not fit in there. So for 64, you get a 0. And then does 32 fit into 42? Yes, well, true, yes. So you have a 1 in that place. There's six. So you already have you already have 32. 1 times 32 is 32. So you've accounted for 32 out of the 42 you're trying to represent. How much do you have left? 10. Okay, does 16 fit into 10? Nope, so a 0 goes there. Does 8 fit into 10? Yes! So we can sort of add that that looks weird. 1 times 8 equals 40. That doesn't appear to be right. Ah, okay, so here you can add that to your the 32 you had before from that first one on the, I guess that's my right and your left. So you can add that onto your 32, and now you've accounted for 40, sorry. You've accounted for 40 of your 42 that you're trying to represent. So here you have 2 remaining. Yay! And then you ask yourself again, does, you know, 4 fit into 2? Nope. Does 2 fit into 2? Yes! Perfect! And then you have your 42. So 1 does not fit into 0. Yay! So that would be 42 in binary. Cool. So questions on this? I think I have an algorithm for you here. So if you're asked to convert from decimal, say some, you know, 42, 72, whatever, to binary, here's the algorithm we were just using. So first you sort of take the biggest byte of what's remaining, and then you ask yourself what's left, you know, subtraction, and then you just repeat that, putting ones and zeros where appropriate in the digits. So you can, you know, you might want to draw some sort of table like the one up here, and as long as you, you know your powers of 2 or can multiply by 2, you can figure out which position corresponds with which power of 2. Yay! You guys will ace this part on the exam if it's there? You better. Okay, anyway, moving on. To go from binary to decimal, i.e., what's that number 10001 in decimal? How do you do that? Well, you can probably probably have some notion of, why don't I go backwards from the algorithm that was shown on the other slide? Yeah, you can do something like that. In my opinion, it's a bit easier because you already have, you know, the ones and the zeros. You just need to match them up with the places and then add them together. What I mean by this is, you know, here's the number that we were given. Are there questions? Okay, so here's our binary number. You just put the ones and the zeros in the correct slots, starting from the right side. And then you do a bit of math, you know, 1 times 16, because there's a 1 in the 16's column, plus 1 times 1, because there's a 1 in the 1's column, and all the zeros you know, anything multiplied by 0, 0. So yay! We figured out that binary number up there equals 17. Yay! Questions on this? In my opinion, it's easier than going the other way around. But, you know, it's not too hard either way if you remember how to go about doing it. So here's sort of an algorithm to do this. You know, figure out which power of 2 is on or 1 or present from your binary number. And then just mathematically add all those that are on or present or 1. And I guess, you know, also have your table. Questions on how to convert from one to the other? Okay. So, without any questions, time for me to ask you guys a question. For practice, I guess, or for those viewing at home or viewing later, you can like pause it after I show you the question and then try to figure it out and see what happens. So I'm not sure if you guys have heard this quote. It's one of my favorite. It used to be on my email signature. And the quote is, there are only 1-0 types of people in this world, those who know binary and those who don't. So are... nice. Snicker, snicker. Okay. So are there really 10 types of people in the world? How come it only lists, you know, those who know binary and those who don't? There's only 2, right? What? What's going on here? Wait, I think the question... Oops, okay. So what's going on here? Would anyone care to explain? Especially those who are snickering? Yes? True. So 1-0, as a binary number, if you draw out the table, you'll see that there's a 1 in the 2's column and a 0 in the 1's column, which makes it 2. So in essence, this actually says there are only 2 types of people in the world, those who know binary, i.e. those who can, you know, who get the joke, and those who don't, who kind of look at you weird and say that you can't count or something like that. I don't know. I like this quote. You should go try it on some people, see what happens. Not sure. Maybe not. Maybe they'll think you're a geek and then, uh-oh. Cool. So our next question is, what's 61 in binary? And then I think I've provided you a hint. Table! Yes! Yes?
1, 1, 1, 0, 1.
Okay, so well, 1. Sure. Okay. Well, yeah. So starting from 32's column.
Oh, okay, can I ask a question about this then?
Sure.
So, because it finishes out 0, 1, and then 1, 1, 1, 0, 1. So, yeah.
Yep.
My question is, we stop at 64, but if we continue on to 128, in your column specifically, so theoretically, if you were to expand that out, it would continue to be 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0.
Yes, so here with your table, if you continue to expand out the columns, so the next one would be like 128, then all of those would indeed be 0.
Okay.
I'm just, you know, I don't have infinite space, but... Yes. Other questions? No questions? Okay. Yay, awesome answering of question time, guys. I am impressed. Okay, so let's talk about binary and computers. Let's put it more in context. Why are we learning binary? You know, what's binary have to do with anything? So for computers, everything comes down to bits. You know, magnetized particles or transistors, things like that. So in hardware, you know, as I've sort of alluded to before, you have transistors, which are either on or off, and that with several like logic circuits and other circuits, you can compute, you know, math, or you can compute read-write operations. And then you also have, as I'll talk about later, in your hard disk drive, you have magnetic particles, or in your floppy drive, I guess, or floppy disk, I suppose, you have these particles that can be either oriented north or south, you know, also binary, one or zero. And then, so those are a few examples of, you know, things all going down to, like, bits. So some terminology or some language, I guess, is, or jargon, I suppose, or math conversions. Okay, so anyway, 8 bits equals 1 byte. And then 10 24 bytes equals a kilobyte. That's kind of different from the system I know from engineering, because there's that 24 there, but it makes it a nice power of 2, which is why, you know, which is why it is used instead of like 1,000. And then, you know, 10 24 kilobytes is a megabyte, and then 10 24 megabytes is a giga, 10 24 of giga is a tera, and then you can keep going up like that. But that's sort of the hierarchy, I guess, if of the prefixes, if you want to think about it like that, just in case you, you know, want to know. But yeah. Wait, do I have... Ah, no. Okay, you didn't see that. Anyway, notice how pretty much everything is 1024, except for 8 bits equaling 1 byte. So you could just probably lump everything else sort of together if you remember the order, and then just remember 8 bits, 1 byte. Yay! There's also something called a nibble, but, you know, won't talk about that, because I don't think it's that important. So, it's a question time again! Yay! What am I going to ask now? Well, you guys get a joke. It's not going to be one of those boring questions, you know, like, translate this or something like that. It's going to be a joke. So imagine that you're watching this scene unfold. There's a computer scientist with his, I don't know, nerdy glasses or whatever. He walks into a butcher's shop and he goes, hey, I want to buy a kilo of meat. And then the butcher, okay, yeah, sure, weighs it out, whatever. He brings it to him. The computer scientist takes it home. And then he comes back 5 minutes later, whatever. And he says, hey, I've been cheated. What do you, you know, what do you take me for, huh? So the butcher's like, I don't understand what you're talking about. He weighs it, and it's exactly 1,000 grams. Hmm. So the butcher's like, you know, what's your problem? So the techie, the computer scientist, says, that's exactly my problem. It's only 1,000 grams. Now, what is going on? Like, why? Like, has he been cheated? Is he, like, faking it? Is he trying to get money? Yes. Yes. Yes, so the... Yes, exactly. So the answer was that to get this joke, you have to realize that, as the previous slide said before, everything sort of is in terms of 1024. Like, from byte to kilobyte, it's 1024. And then here, we sort of relay it back to the, I don't want to say real world, but the more common notion that a kilo is 1,000. So yay! Yeah, so essentially, this all hinges on the guy being a computer scientist and being used to the 1024 system, I suppose. So this was also already answered. How much he thought he lost was 24, or how, because, you know, as I explained before, everything's in more or less 1024 as opposed to 1,000. So yay! You guys get nerdy jokes now. I'm so happy. I can, like, talk to you guys, and you guys won't laugh at me. Or at least you'll understand the joke and then laugh at me. Cool. So moving on, let's talk about how do you use binary or these ones and zeros, these on and off positions, to represent anything, to represent data, to represent programs. You know, how in the world is a whole bunch of zeros and ones going to make the letter A or, like, an image on your screen? So for that, we have more or less standard mappings, one of which that we talked about a lot in lecture was ASCII. I don't expect you to know this. Well, I guess you can memorize it if you want. But I bolded the word standard code go back to the notion of, you know, having standard mappings of certain numbers equaling, like, certain characters or certain protocols or things like that. But for ASCII, this code or this mapping, it uses 8 bits for this one. And another example that was sort of talked about in lecture or touched on is Unicode, which uses 16 or more bits. So that's just, like, you know, another little note, I suppose, if you want to go look that up and study. But I'm going to talk about ASCII. So the question was, what's Unicode? Unicode is just It's like ASCII in that it's another standard mapping, except it uses 16 or more bits, so you can map more characters or, I guess, because as you'll see later on, ASCII is not just about characters. It's also like control characters and things like that, which is kind of weird. But I will show you. So here we have, for the ASCII representation, we have an ASCII table, which sort of lists the mapping, you know, key and value, I guess, if you want to think about it like that. It's not just numbers and letters, like I've said before. You also have punctuation, control characters. When I show you the table, I'll point those out so you guys have a better idea of what I'm talking about. But possibly, if you want to memorize something, you should probably know that capital A is 65, and then lowercase is 97. Then you can sort of go from there and figure out what big B or little z or whatever it is. So if you, you know, just know those two markers, then you essentially know the numbers for the rest of the alphabet, caps and uncaps. So here's our ASCII table, right here in all its like entirety, I guess. So as you can see, here's our big A, 65, and our little A. Hopefully you can see my mouse up there. Little A, 97. When I was talking about control characters, I meant things like these over here. I don't think you really need to know this, but like here you can see 2 represents the start of text. And it's in parentheses because it's not like a character you can spit out. It just represents that. Or if, I suppose, bell might be the dinging sound your computer makes. I'm not quite sure about that. But, you know, here are like characters that you can't really spit out on screen, like a, you know, a plus sign or some letters or numbers. So here's just the ASCII table. So guys, question time! Let's apply our knowledge! So let's say you receive a top secret message. And it looks something like this. Just three clumps of 8, I suppose. And you're bent on figuring out what it says. Does anyone have an idea of what it might be or how to proceed or like what are these numbers? Hint, hint, they're zeros and ones. They're in clumps of 8. Wonder what they could stand for. Well, since this might be a bit math intensive and I don't really have a calculator on screen, I'm not sure if you guys have calculators, but I'll just let you know that that equals 71. You know, if you followed the previous slides examples with that table and then you figure out which one belongs to which column and then you add them all up, you get 71. Okay, 71, what the heck does that mean? G, yes, indeed. So if you'll see up here, I've sort of highlighted G because that's the mapping on our ASCII table. So G, three characters beginning with G, I wonder what that means. Let's go on to our second one. 76, what is that? Let's see, 76 up there, where is it? It's right there, L, G-L, question mark? Maybe you guys already know what it says, maybe you can guess what the last thing is. But here it's sort of tricky, it's 33, which I haven't shown on my little ASCII table here. But if we go back, here we go, you can see 33 is exclamation point. G-L exclamation point. Ah, get it? No? No laughter? Well, GL is my, you know, text talk, right? Whenever my friends and I send each other GL, it usually means good luck with an exclamation point. So good luck, guys. You can do it. You know this stuff. Cool. So yay, you guys can decode secret messages of this form. I hope. Okay, so let's move on to hardware. Yeah, well, I guess bigger hardware, not the super low-level binary and bits hardware. Okay, so let's talk about, or let's review, I suppose, the brains of your computer, i.e. the CPU, the central processing unit. So it looks something like this on screen. This, the one on the left, has a nice little cover over it, but under that cover, it looks something like this. You know, in case you have to identify it by sight or something like that. And then inside your, you know, motherboard or your computer, it looks something like this. This board here has 2 CPUs. You can see them marked CPU1, CPU2. So it's this like square that's usually bigger than things around it, but it's this like square that's set in your board if you have to like identify it. And then also remember when David was passing around his CPU or his little board, there was this weird square thing that sat on top of where the CPU was supposed to be with like spikes or pokey things poking out, sort of like this up here, this grayish thing. I guess the picture's not very good quality. But that's a heat sink, and that pretty much channels the heat up through its spikes so that there's more like surface area that it can like dissipate off of. So in short, it just helps transfer the heat faster away from your CPU, because you don't want your CPU to like heat up and like start burning like some of the laptops Bio made back in the day. That used to be in the news, I think, a lot. But yeah, heat sinks, awesome. Heat sinks, fans, keep your computer cooler. So what the CPU does is it executes instructions or tasks, you know, using the very low level of bits and binary and stuff like that. And then one question you might ask is, well, where do these instructions come from? Where are they stored? How does it get these instructions? Well, that's our next slide. Oh, or I guess here it tells you from memory, and then that's our next slide. We're going to talk about memory. We have two types of memory, two, quote unquote, two. See why I say quote-unquote in a bit. There's persistent or permanent, PP, if you need something to remember, letter P, and it stays on, or it stays around even after the power is off. And then, of course, the opposite, we have volatile, which needs quote-unquote constant power. So if you turn off the power for, you know, a while, it goes away. Okay, does anyone remember what two types of memory I might be talking about here? This is like pop quiz question time. Pop question time? I don't know. Yes?
I think it's a hard drive and a RAM. The RAM is a volatile.
Yes, so RAM and the hard disk drive, but which is which?
The hard drive is permanent, and the RAM is electricity.
Yes, so the hard drive is the persistent or the permanent, quote unquote, one, and the volatile one is RAM. Yay! Yes. Pop question time. Was good. So here's an analogy that I sort of like to think, or here's one that I came up in my psych class because I was learning psych. I'd like to think of HDD as long-term memory. You know, you have it stored and you can, you know, you're going to remember it, you know, several days after, whereas RAM is sort of like short-term memory. You know, you might forget it in like 5 minutes or something like that. So it's sort of like a loose analogy if you have trouble thinking about memory. Like two types of memory, what? And then for the HDD, it's usually a larger space. And for RAM, it's usually a smaller space. And as, well, maybe I won't do the demo. But like if you look at the specs on this laptop, my computer, for my hard disk drive, I have about like 300 gigabytes versus like 3 gigabytes for my RAM. And then, yeah, just so you can sort of see how much larger, smaller, or like the magnitude difference. An idea. And then the hard disk drive is slower access. And then RAM is faster because, well, RAM is electrical, so things move faster, you know, at the speed of light or something close to it. Versus mechanical, you have all those motors and things that need to move and get into place. So RAM is faster than HDD. So memory access. I.e. putting this together. How does it happen? Well, first I should sort of remind you that there's also L1 and L2 caches. They're faster than RAM. They're usually on the CPU itself, and they're small, like smaller than RAM, like much smaller. And they were implemented as sort of an optimization because, you know, a while ago they were like, RAM is fast, but if you can get faster, that's usually better. So people sort of came up with the idea of L1 and L2 caches to make things even faster. There's also like L3 and L4, but let's not go into that. So here's how it's, you know, works. Here's how you can think about it. You have your hard disk, and that has all your like long-term data storage. And then you have your RAM, which is, you know, volatile. After you turn off your computer, it sort of goes away after a few minutes. Your caches, which, you know, more or less are on your CPU. Cool, and then we have our CPU, which has our caches on them. Like, I didn't want to put the squares on top of the CPU because, I don't know, I thought that was not very aesthetically pleasing. But anyway, so you get data from your hard HDD, you plop it into RAM, And then it goes from RAM into your CPU, you know, passing through your L1 and your L2. And then, you know, your CPU executes it and sends things back out or gets more instructions. That's sort of how it, you know, the pathway that happens. So, question time, guys. Let's say you're studying for this exam, and then suddenly you get this vague notion of, you know, an analogy, something about your bookshelf, you know, which is like far away, containing a whole bunch of your books and things, and you have your desk, and then you have your brain. Somehow this reminds you of hardware and maybe memory access or something. Does anyone have an idea what or how these could relate to, you know, what we've just talked about? Maybe? I guess since this might be more of a, you know.
Is your hard disk, the disk is your brain, and the brain is the CPU?
Yes! So here's the analogy I was sort of pushing you towards, but bookshelf is your hard disk. Desk is your RAM, and your brain could be your CPU. So, you know, your bookshelf, it's a large data collection. It's, I guess, I'd like to think of it as permanent. You know, you have your books. You're not going to burn them at some point or give them away, I hope. And then when you want to study or whatever, you go over, you grab that data, pop it on your desk. You know, you're retrieving that data to put on your desk to, like, immediately use. And then your brain, you know, you process that retrieved data. You start studying from it. You start reading about it and so forth. Yay! So if you need an analogy of, like, how this memory axis works, you can think about it like that. Or you can think about, like, long-term memory, short-term memory. But yay! Awesome, guys. Cool. So let's talk about accessing the hard disk drive. How do we do that again? Well, if you sort of recall back in lecture, you guys were shown a video. But I don't have that neat video with me, so I'll just try to do it in pictures. Sort of a brief summary or overview is you have the stack of platters, sort of these round disks with magnetic particles on them. And then you have this arm with these heads on them that sort of glide over your disks reading data, like they glide in unison. Hopefully that's bringing back a few memories, either from class or from studying or from watching videos. Here's a close-up of one of those heads. You can sort of imagine how they, you know, they're really close to the platter such that I think not even a human hair could, like, fit underneath, just to be very accurate. And they're very delicate, so if you, like, drop your laptop or anything, and if this breaks, that's terrible. Yay! So let's talk about the platter, because you already saw the little head thing. Let's talk about the platter. It looks, you can sort of imagine it looking sort of like this. It's it has sectors, and I guess if you want to think about it, rings that gets smaller as you go into the disk. This is where the data is written. And the platter has magnetic particles on it, as I've mentioned earlier. And the disk spins. That's part of how the arm sort of finds where to, you know, pick up the data, read the data, write the data. And here's a number for you in case you need to remember it for whatever. It spins usually at, like, maybe 5,400 RPM, rotations per minute. So that's super fast, in my opinion. But you'd get some sort of unit like this or some sort of number like this if you were asked, you know, how fast is, you know, your disk spin or something like that. Cool. And as I've said before, you have these magnetic particles that can be polarized north or south, and, you know, that's how the binary is represented. The data is represented in binary. And then the thing here is, when you write or read data, it doesn't have to be in a contiguous block, you know, around the disk or near the disk. It can be scattered all over. And then you have this sort of this other file, this other page that keeps track of, you know, the end of this segment of data, you know, where it should go next. So, you know, just so you know, it's not a big contiguous block. It can be, but it can also be scattered throughout. And there's, if you want to think about it, like pointers or something that sort of link all the data, so the head knows where to go next and where to pick up the next piece of information. Yay! So, we had a little tie-in with floppy disk drives with, like, another video, I think, which I do not possess, this video. But you can sort of think of floppy disk drives if you guys know what those are. You know, it's kind of old, not really around anymore. Sort of think of them as mini HDDs. You know, they're just, if you open one up, you'll see it's this floppy little disk thing that has magnetic particles on it. The drive itself has a read-write head, but it doesn't move with an arm, you know, so it doesn't scan over your floppy paper-looking thing. And like I said before, the platter is this floppy circle of magnetic material, and you know, you can sort of think about it like a HDD where you have your read-write head, and it uses electricity to read the polarity of the particles, and then to read or write the polarity of the particles. And that's how floppy disks work, if you guys still use them. So, question time, yay! Interactive portion of quiz time, or of review. So let's say you have this friend who's, you know, back in the day, packed up all his data on floppy disks, and he has like stacks and stacks of them. Now he's lamenting to you how his laptop and most computers that he's ever seen nowadays, seen like now, presently, they don't have floppy disk drives. So he's like lamenting, I can't access all my floppy disks. Like, is all hope lost? Like, is all that data, like can he not ever access it again? What could you suggest to your friend? Any ideas? Or is all hope lost? Are all his backups like, you know, useless now? If his computer crashes and he loses all his Word docs, he can't get them back anymore? Or question to think about? Yes?
No, all hope is not lost.
Yes.
Because I would suggest to him that you could go to your local computer store and you can buy an adapter that reads floppy disks. You can convert USB, whatever. No, but the access is still there, and it's still readable if you have the proper equipment to read it.
Yes, so that's an excellent answer. So the answer was, no, hope is not lost. You could totally tell your friend to go to his, you know, Radio Shack or his tech store, Fry's Electronics, whatever you want, and then pick up an adapter so that he could plug it into one of the other ports on his computer, or he can, you know, attach it to his computer and get a floppy disk drive so that he can actually access those floppy disks, even though his computer originally did not have that drive. So that sort of ties into my next slide. I can't really pronounce his word, but you guys can read it. So main gist of this is computers have slots and ports, not the same as internet ports and things, but physical like slots and, you know, ports, indentations on your laptop or your computer that you can, you know, plug additional things in. So there are some that I like to call internal. So you can, as you probably have heard, you can install additional RAM, or you can install like a graphics card, a better graphics card, or, you know, other things of that sort. Oops. So what I mean by these slots is, you sort of see them right here. These are slots for additional RAM, I think it is. So you have that thin piece of green and black thing, and you just sort of slot it in carefully, not touching the connectors at the end. Possibly according to the instructions manual. Here you go. These right here. So these long, like if you remember the image of RAM I showed a few slides back, they were like long, flat, I guess, strips, if you want to call them that. You can just slot them into these things right here. And then your computer can have more RAM. Yay! Awesome. More RAM equals good, in my opinion, because I get it. Anyway, so there's also external. You know, there's internal, there's external. These things maybe you're more familiar with. They're like ports or little slots on your computer or laptop. Usually, like on the outside, you don't have to open it up and look at the motherboard or anything. You can connect things like printers, your mouse, your keyboard. If you have a desktop, it's easier to see. Or you can sort of see how I have my mouse connected with a USB down here. Well, I guess you can't really see it here. But here, you see my mouse is connected. And then there's also this cool thing called a USB, a universal serial port. So this, so one end can be the USB and the other end can be a lot of things, say an adapter or an adapter for a floppy disk drive, or I don't know, maybe it connects to your camera, but it's called a universal for a reason, universal. And so forth. So if you look at the back of your computer, or maybe some old computers, you'd probably see something like this, with all its little ports where you can put your keyboards or your mouse. Usually they're color-coded to help you in case you accidentally unplug things and you don't want to look at the manual. You can also see there's audio ports, you know, for your mics and your speakers or your headphones. USB ports, yes, I love those. And there's all those other ports that you can connect things to. So do you guys see these things under computers? I guess your laptops has it too. My laptop has, does it have stuff? Well, I guess it has this port thing over here, all this stuff. With this VGA cable so I can like project for you guys, but yay. Cool. So you guys might be able to identify some of these ports if you see them, maybe. Not sure what's on the exam, but I'm just, you know, in case we did pass around, you know, a motherboard and all that. That's weird.
Question.
Yes?
On that image that you have, is the
this one?
Back one?
Mm-hmm.
The right behind the RAM?
This.
Yes, is that the graphics card port?
I'm actually not sure what port that is for. Well, because usually when I'm, you know, messing around with my motherboard or whatever, I have, like, a diagram. Usually they'll label. I'm not sure if you can see the labels here. They'll label, you know, this is some technical name or, you know, CPU or something like that. So, yeah. Yay. So, let's move on towards the internets, which, I don't know, hopefully super familiar-ish to you guys. But here's an overview, a very simplistic idea of what the internet and communicating on the internet is all about. Say you have your computer, i.e. a client, quote-unquote, to use the jargon. A client because you're about to, you know, get served some data or ask for some data and be served. And then there's sort of a server, or I guess it's over here, a server somewhere off. Maybe it's next to you. Maybe it's like off in Canada or something. And a server is just pretty much a machine that sits there, and its whole purpose is to, you know, receive requests and send things back. So, you know, send data back, or maybe, you know, send images or send HTML pages. It's just there to serve, you know, data or services like email or something like that. So here's the simplistic model or simplistic idea. You know, your computer, i.e. a client, sends a request in, you know, on the slide I've represented it as hello world. You know, maybe it's talking to the server, and then the server, you know, responds. So that's a simplistic idea. You know, request response. Hey. Well, getting a bit more into detail, you have your computer, you have a server. You know, there's distance all around you, I guess. What's more like reality is you have a whole bunch of routers situated throughout, you know, the geographic location, and then when your computer sends a request, i.e. hello world or whatever, it jumps from your computer to like router, and then each of those routers sort of check out, as you've heard in lecture, check out where your request is supposed to go, you know, your data packet or whatever, where it's supposed to go, and it sort of does a bit of math, and it figures out, you know, which router should I send this next? So it's not just like, oh, I'm just going to send out random data and hopefully it'll get to your server. There's, you know, some calculation and some like direction that your packets take. So hopefully they end up at the server, you know, your request. And then the server responds and sends a response back. Maybe it takes the same route, maybe it doesn't. It sort of depends on, you know, traffic times then and what the individual routers sort of calculate for you. Yay! So that's sort of a more, I suppose, accurate picture of the request-response model or event that happens. Yay? Cool? Okay. So if there aren't any questions... what's this? Okay. That's weird. Question time! Yay! My favorite part of this, yes. Maybe we should do this during section. That might be fun. Anyway, so say you have this friend in Japan who refers you to a download page because she's found this awesome, like, awesome program called Scratch, which I think you guys will be working with later on. And she's like, OMG, you got to download this. And then the page she sends you has several download mirrors or locations, you know, where it, I guess, lives that you can download from. And your friend who's from Japan says, you should click the Japan link and download it because it connects really fast, quote unquote. And she recommends, you know, doing it because she You know, both of you don't really like slow things. Now, would you click it? Would you download from Japan? Or would you not? Does it matter? Yes. Yes. So, as aptly said, the answer is you probably don't want to click the Japan link because, you know, you're probably going to download from a server that's based in Japan, and that's far from you, assuming you live in the U.S. If you live in Japan, then that's perfectly fine. But and then if you try to download from a server that's far from you, when you request something, it'll take longer to, like, travel there and then come back to you. So this question was just sort of aimed at asking you, you know, what's the point of, geographic locations, do they matter, I suppose? Or why would one want to put a whole bunch of data centers all over the place, like Google does? Or why do you want routers all over the place? So this ties into, like, a topic that I think is interesting, and Dan has mentioned several times, latency versus download speed. Can get a bit confusing. It was confusing for me when I first thought about it. But latency is the delay between when data is requested and then received. So the simplistic model I showed you in the beginning, where your computer says, "Hey, you know, request," and then receives a response. So that's latency, and it's usually measured in milliseconds, ms. So when Dan did his trace route, you saw those little numbers off to the right. Sorry, I don't have a photo of that. But there were numbers off to the right in milliseconds, sort of saying how long it took for, you know, his request to come back to him. So if you, I guess, look back at the lectures or the slides, you can see those numbers and then know how long it took for his, you know, request to go to CNN, I think it was. So download speed, let's talk about that now, is how fast data transfers. That might sound kind of confusing because they're both dealing with speed. I have an analogy in a little bit, but just a bit of information. This is usually measured in megabits per second. So big M, B, slash S. If you're kind of iffy on the abbreviation, and if it's asked on the test, I guess you could just write it out. So notice it's megabits and not like megabytes. And then here's the analogy that hopefully will clear it up for you, or at least give you a better sense of, you know, difference between the two. So let's say you're turning on a garden hose. So latency in this case would be the time it takes for the water to come out of the nozzle. You know, if you, like, my mom used to make me water her roses. So I'd have my brother stand at the other end because I'm lazy. Like, "Hey, bro, you know, turn on the faucet." And then I'd stand there and wait until the water, you know, gets there. We had a long hose, so it took a while. So you can think of latency sort of like that. And then the download speed is sort of how fast the water, like, flows out. So if you turn up the faucet, you can have, like, a really, like, really powerful stream, or you can have, like, sort of a weak, like, arching stream. So you can sort of think about it like that, maybe. Download speed versus latency. Maybe, hopefully, sit on it. Questions on this? Better analogy? Always up for those. Okay, so hopefully that's straightened out. Let's move on and talk about IP addresses. So you have these requests and these responses going through routers from computers to servers. How do they know where to send something or where something ends up? That's where IP addresses come into play. Okay, so, you know, how does data know where to go? You can't just, like, randomly, you know, shoo it off and hope that it finds its destination. That'd be a poor model of, you know, postal mail. That'd be pretty bad. But cool. So answer is IP addresses. IP stands for Internet Protocol, which, you know, in the name you can guess it's a protocol or a set of rules on how to have the internet run, or how to run the internet efficiently, I hope. So IP addresses. That's how things get addressed to each other. So currently we're using IP version 4. So that's just the protocol version 4. I hear people are hoping to switch to version 6, where we can have more addresses and, you know, more efficient routing and stuff like that. So these IP addresses, IP version 4, because version 6 has more stuff and letters and other things that I'm not going to go into here. But IP version 4 has the form WXYZ, where each of those letters is an octet, or a number from 0 to 255. Now, 0 to 255 and octet, what do they have? Like, how are they related, you might think or wonder why it's called an octet. Well, if you remember back to our talk on binary and bits, if you have 8 bits, i.e. an octet of bits, you can represent, the biggest number you can represent is, or you can represent 0 to 255. So that's the relationship between octets and 0 to 255, and, you know, sort of reviewing binary and bits. Okay, so now that you know that there's 8 bits in each of these letters up here, how many possible IP addresses do we have again using this form? It's more. Yes, wait, come again? Around 4 billion. So, well, I'm guessing here's how you got it. You have four octets. That means 32 bits. And then each bit can be on or off. So you just have 2 raised to the 32, and you have your 4.2 billion. So an example of an IP address is just, that's what I had like a week ago when I looked at my IP on whatsmyip.com. There's an example. You'll notice that each of the numbers are between 0 and 255. Yay! Let's take a break. Break time. So, during the break, we had a question about why is 255 sort of the largest number you can have? And that goes back to each of these letters being an octet of bits, and each of those being, 8 bits. And if we recall that each bit can be a 0 or 1, I've drawn up here a not very straight, it's not very aligned, but, sorry, a representation of what... of 8 binary digits, 8 bits here. So say all of these were 1. Okay, now I guess I have to put 1. That's a 1. If all of these were 1s, what number would we get? All of these were 1s. What's the largest number we can represent with 8 bits, essentially, is the question. Yes. That's, I think you get, yes, 255. Yes, so that's where the 255 comes from. And then, of course, your smallest number would be 0, with everything as 0. Yay! Tying bits back in! I love tying stuff back in. It's awesome. So moving on with IP addresses. Here's the form I said they had before in our IP version 4. Now, once we switch to IP version 6, you'll have to, if you're still interested, you'll have to, there's a new form and there's a format and all that. But here's what we have now. And Dan sort of mentioned class A's or classes that that some IP addresses or that IP addresses have, and they're usually the W or the leftmost side of the IP address usually represents. That's kind of convoluted. But anyway, just know that the W is sort of what determines the class. And then classes are just chunks of IP addresses for different entities. So like, entities could be corporations, they could be a university like MIT who has, a whole class A chunk for themselves, which I don't know, I'm kind of jealous about. Not that I use that many IP addresses, but still. And then, how they cut up, I guess, if you want to think about it that way, cut up IP addresses to sort of give out to different corporations or people and such. There's also the subnet part of the IP address, which is generally on the left side. It could be, it could be WX, or it could be WX and Y, or it could be, something like that. So it's generally on the left side, not necessarily W and X only. But I can't really have probabilistic animation, so I'm just going to include W and X. And this represents like subnetwork or adjacent machines that are sort of on the same-ish network as your machine or of that network, if that makes sense. And then the rest of it, you know, aside from the subnet, i.e. the generally the right side, which may or may not be Y and Z, could just be like Z only, is pretty much the individual machine or host identifier. So that's sort of the anatomy of a IP address. Questions on this? Okay. More IP addresses, yay! Apparently this is a very big topic. So for IP addresses, you can have public IP addresses, i.e. Addresses that other machines can sort of contact or sort of that other machines see on like the big wide internet, worldwide internet. And you can have private IP addresses where you know only see it within that network, or that other people can't see, or other people can't like use to send things to that machine. So let's go back to the idea that each machine on the internet needs an IP address. Yay, nay? Well, kind of. And I say kind of because say at home you have, I don't know, three computers, and they're all, say, on the internet at the same time because your siblings and your parents are on there too. Does that mean each of those computers has, you know, an IP address on the internet? Not quite. That's why I say kind of. So for a network, each machine should be, you know, uniquely identifiable, you know, i.e. have an IP address, but it can be private such that only the network sees it. And when you interface with like the internet through, say, your router, your home router, then you know, your home router can just have one public IP address that's like the face for the internet, and it can coordinate between your home network and your private IP addresses and, you know, the internet and its public addresses and such. So it's not necessarily that each machine that's connected to the internet will have its own public IP address. It'll probably have its own private IP, yes, but not necessarily its own public one. So in conclusion, I guess if you want to think about it that way, is networked machines can sort of all be represented by one, quote unquote, public IP address, the address of, you know, the router or the mediator that that's connected to their network. But they will have private IP addresses. This is called network address translation, NAT, which is awesome because it sort of helps lessen, I guess, or slow the problem of, oh no, we're running out of IP addresses. Because, you know, you can have several computers connected to one network and they're only taking up one public IP address, which is, in my opinion, good, right? Then you can have more public IP addresses for other networks or other machines, things like that. But yay, happy. I like NAT. So a visual representation of this network, this NAT is simplified visual, of course, is say you have your home network or, you know, a network. Let's just say it's your home. And then you have your home router. And then you have the internet with that big worldwide globe thing there. So what happens is, say, you know, your machines on your network sends data or sends requests to, or are trying to send requests to the internet. So all of those things go to your router, and say each of those machines there, I've tried to color code it, has, you know, a private IP address. And you can sort of see that the last number changes according to, in my example, changes according to like different machines on that network. On that home network. So it goes to your router, yay! And then your router sort of remembers who sent what, or who's, you know, who sent what, pretty much. And then it puts on its public IP address, which is all the same, and it sends that to the World Wide Web. So the World Wide Web, or the internet, doesn't know that all these machines have all these private IP numbers. It just knows that, oh, there's this machine, the router, or this, you know, this router here that has that address. It sent me all this stuff. So when I, you know, send the response, I'm going to send it to that address, i.e. the router, and then the home router will figure out, you know, which goes to what machine. Yay, isn't that awesome? That little thin box thing knows how to do all this and more. I think it's pretty awesome. Yay. Yes. Yes, definite yes. Cool. That's weird. Not sure why I did that. Okay, so we have all these IP addresses, right? Hopefully you've noticed that they're all a bunch of numbers, 0 to 255. And when we type something into our URL, it's not, you know, a bunch of numbers, but it's something like, I don't know, CNN.com, Yahoo.com, Google.com. Like, what's the link between the two? How do you go from the numbers, IP addresses, to these domain names? Well, there's something called, oh, that's weird, the domain name system. So you can think of this, as Dan sort of mentioned, as a phone book or a giant dictionary of, or a giant mapping of IP addresses to domain names. So you can sort of imagine how when you type in, when your computer tries to look up CNN.com, it goes and it figures out, the IP address or addresses that CNN has for its servers, and it uses those to send out its, you know, data and its packets and stuff. Cool. And it's not necessarily a one-to-one relation. One domain name can have several IP addresses, as you saw with Dan's traceroute and CNN. I think CNN had like 5 different IPs or something like that. IP addresses, I mean. So, yeah, it's not a one-to-one relation. It's not one domain name to like one IP address. It can be more to one. And then also recall how Dan talked about this last lecture, which hopefully is still fresh in your mind, about top-level domains or domain names. Okay. So these are things that end in, I think he had a list. There were things like .edu, .com. There were also country top-level domain names like .us, .uk, .tv. That sounds pretty cool, right? .tv. If you had a TV show, you might want that domain. Or domain name, rather. And then there are also things called subdomains. So going off of our example, say harvard.edu is the top level. And then, you know, we also have subdomains like FAS. And notice how it's appended to the left of the top level domain name. Yay! And then, so that possibly raises the question of, you know, how does one go about looking up these mappings in this phone book, this system? How do you, you know, figure out what IP and what domain name go together or whatever? Luckily for us, it's automatic, using the DHCP, Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol. As the name suggests, protocol, you know, a set of rules on how to do things. And dynamic, yay, that's always good, right? So how does this work, or what's it do? Well, it allows your computer, your machine, to communicate with the internet. That's a very loose, you know, definition or idea of what it does. So before we move on, question time! We haven't had one of those in a while. So yes, pop quiz. Kidding. Huh. So let's say you get an email with a domain of bank.ofamerica.com. And it's requesting your account number and your PIN and maybe where you live and your social security number, blah, 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 blah. Is it legitimate? Like, there's bankofamerica.com, what? It's right there.
No.
Ah, yes. So, emphatic no. It's not legitimate. If you'll notice, it's ofamerica.com is its, you know, main, I guess, domain name, which I don't think is very trustworthy. And what's with this subdomain of bank just appended on to ofamerica.com? That definitely does not look like, you know, if you go to bankofamerica.com's actual real web page, you'll notice that its URL doesn't quite look like that. And someone else is just trying to make it seem like maybe this is from Bank of America. Yay! So I'm glad you guys realize that, no, this is bad. They're trying to get your account number and PIN and social security and all that other stuff. Yay! Cool. So, connecting all of it together. Let's say you have your client, your computer, and it's like, I want to connect to the internets. And then you have this protocol, DHCP. It's like, okay, hang on a bit. I gotta prepare you, I gotta prep you for the internet. So DHCP provides for you or your computer an IP address to ID that machine, or rather an IP address to your home router, which has the public IP number, remember? And then it also sort of gives the machine, whichever is interfacing with you and the internet, a DNS server list for domain names, so it can look up IP addresses and sort of map them onto domain names and see, you know, where you're trying to go to. So it knows that CNN.com is actually, you know, these IP addresses here, so that you don't have to do it yourself, which I think is awesome. And then it's also, DHCP also provides you, you know, where's the closest router to send, you know, your information off to the internet, so the gateway router. Where's the closest sort of node that you can, you know, get your information there, and then it can send it on its way. And it also uses the subnet mask to determine, you know, it uses a subnet mask on the IP addresses that you give or you're trying to go to determine if what you're trying to send is on the same network. Because then it'll have to go through a different like set of rules. Say you wanted to send something in your own network, you know, say you don't want to, it doesn't need to go through the internet or whatever, then if you knew, or I guess if using DHCP, it can just send it off within the network and it doesn't have to like go to the internet. So, I mean, it's useful to know which computers are sort of on the same network or adjacent to yours. You know, it can choose a different set of rules or protocols to follow. So, yay, subnet mask. It's useful. And it's all automatic, so you don't have to actually go in and type it in for yourself, because I'd never really get that right, and then you won't ever see me on the internet. Cool, so let's touch on a bit about how data travels. Sort of talking about what Dan talked about last lecture. He said it travels in packets. If you remember his analogy, his example, he had those envelopes with like notes in them, i.e. data, and then the envelopes are like packets, and they have, here we go, they're numbered, so you know how many packets you're expecting, you know which packet this is of the whole, you know, whole package. It has sort of a from field, quote unquote from, and there's a to field. It's obviously it's not going to say from colon, you know, whatever. It's you know, within its format. So, and it has information as such. So it has information needed so that the routers and the when you use the protocols on them, they know where the packet should be going to, or if the packet has been lost, it'll send another one. But so what I'm trying to get at is when you send data, you don't just send it in a giant chunk that just travels, you know, hopping from router to router or whatever. Because think about the inefficiency. Say, you know, you hit a bad router and it like your big chunk of data goes away. Then it's missing, right? You have to send the whole thing again. Versus if you had packets, you know, you lost one packet. Okay, that's only a small chunk of what you were trying to get. It's easier to send that, and it's, you know, all hopefully the rest of your packets have made it. So, you know, you'd have to resend less. There's, I guess, less probability that it would get lost. In some sort of mathematical way. So yeah, as I said before, if a packet gets lost, there's, you know, a protocol, there's a standard to inform the server that, oh hey, you know, I didn't get your packet. Can you send it again? So this is all part of a protocol called TCP and IP, you know, Internet Protocol, and I think that's Communication Protocol. But it's part of like a standard set of rules that they decided that, hey, this is what we're going to use for the internet, and or use for the internet communications, you know, stuff like that. So yeah, all of this is pretty much done for you, I guess. You don't have to worry about like, oh, I lost a packet. It's 3 or 4. How am I going to get it? You know, the protocol takes care of that, which is awesome. And that's all I have prepared, leaving some time, pocket of time for questions or practice problems if you want me to come up with that. Or we can go through the exam, because I don't know what the real exam looks like, but do look at the practice exam. It's on the front page of the course webpage. There's also answer sheet for you to like check your answers and all that. Yay, questions? Do you guys want to swarm up here and like ask questions or write questions on the board or ask me individual questions? No? All ready for the exam? Gonna ace it? Make me proud, guys. Well, if there aren't any other questions, good luck, guys. And if you ever find you have a question, please do email us, help@computerscienceone.net. A lot of us, many of us, maybe all of us, stay up rather late. You can find me online at like 4 in the morning. I don't know why, but you totally can. So if you have a question, no question is too stupid or silly or whatever, because we all have questions, right? And how are you going to learn if you don't ask them or if you don't try to figure it out? So do email us. You might be surprised at, you know, when we respond, i.e. 4 in the morning, cough, cough. But yeah, you know, we're a friendly bunch. We want to help you succeed. So if there aren't other questions, you have a question? CAT5? Let me pull that up. Well, the question was on the practice exam here that I pulled up. I think it was question 5. Was it question 5? CAT5 cables. So those are like Ethernet cables, and they facilitate like data transfer, I guess, if you want to think about it like that. And here it's sort of asking, you know, in general ballpark, magnitude of 10, I guess, what is their speed, their throughput? I think the answer is, check this out. It has 10 megabytes per second. Remember what I cautioned you guys about, what MB is? Not megabytes, but megabits in terms of download speed and all that. Cool, so watch out for those. But also note that, you know, this is an old exam. It might have a few questions on things that we didn't go over this year. So if you see some, like, way... no weird question that you've never heard of, and there's no way we could have talked about this, and you're absolutely sure of it, no, don't freak out. It could just be that this was covered, you know, in previous years and not in this year. Yay! Yes, question? Throughput. So the question was, what is throughput? I think throughput here is used pretty much as speed that sort of data is transferred, sort of. So, how much something, or how fast you can put data through, I think, if that helps.
So if we take that question, for example.
Mm-hmm. This question. What are you asking?
Question 6.
Okay, 6. Okay, so how would you, well, this looks to me more of a, sort of, I want to say a memorizing number. Memorizing, like being familiar with the numbers. This is one of those moments where you should probably go look it up. Cool. Other questions? Worried looks on your faces?
So number 10.
Pardon?
Number 10.
What is that? The answer is FTP. Okay, so we're talking about question 10 here, which says, wait, let me zoom in. Plus, when you visit a website, that website right there, which protocol does not get, let me pull that over, involved. So I think this is asking for your knowledge of these protocols and what they do. IP, as you know, is Internet Protocol. It's sort of the thing with, it's related with IP addresses. So you can think of it as addressing your packets and things like that. So if you're visiting a website, you probably use that, right? So it's not B. Then HTTP, even if you didn't know what that stood for, you can sort of extrapolate from when you visit a website, let's say Google. Oh, I guess it doesn't show it. There you go. So when you visit like a website, or you've seen hopefully HTTP, you know, on your most of your URLs, and you can sort of extrapolate from there that when you're visiting web pages or, you know, HTTP is used, or that... it's part of sort of accessing URLs and web pages. If you were to go to Facebook and you wanted to upload a file, so uploading a file would, you know, invoke FTP because it's a file transfer protocol, right? You're transferring files. Or if you were uploading files to, say, our own wiki, the course wiki, then you would, you know, be, since you're uploading a file, you're transferring a file, so FTP. Versus, you know, as I was sort of saying before, IP, you know, you can... if you don't recall really what it does, you know, IP addresses, you know, it addresses your data somewhere. So if you were visiting, you know, whitehouse.gov, you can sort of think of it like as, you know, if you were sitting visiting CNN.com, they have like 5 IP addresses. You know, whitehouse.gov probably has several IP addresses, so that would be used. And then if you didn't know what HTTP was, hopefully maybe you'll remember that, oh, you know, a lot of my URLs are prefixed with HTTP, or, oh yeah, Dan did that thing where he had HTTP like /1.0 or something like that when he was sending things to a web page to like visit a URL and you got a whole bunch of like HTML back or something. If you remember that, you know, you can sort of, you know, cross that off the list. Yeah, you know, you probably use that when you're going to whitehouse.gov. And then TCP, as mentioned sort of before, it works with ICP. It works with IP, so there's, you can sort of think of them as paired, kind of. And they handle the whole, you know, I'm going to send out packets, and if you lost one, or one thing they do is if a packet was lost, you know, it sends another one, or it asks for another one, I think. Yay! Testing strategies, guys, yes! Process of elimination and stuff like that. Other questions you want to ask off camera? I don't know. Ready for the test? No? Oh, okay, so the practice tests are all on the course website. If I can. No, I didn't print them out. But
do I have to print them out?
Yes, you do. If you want to practice it. I mean, if you're the type who likes looking, you know, on the web page, then that's fine too.
Okay, yeah.
So they're just practice for you. We'll have the actual exam printed out for you guys, you know, on Monday when you come. Just be sure you bring a pencil and stuff. Cool. So you can find them here, practice exam, as well as the answers. And yay! Don't forget your homework 3, which is like, what, in 2 weeks or something? Just because I tend to write things in like with 8 digits, that doesn't mean all of binary is, you know, confined to eight places.
For the
IP addresses, each of those, like when they made IPv4, they had each of the letters or each of those things separated by the dots. They confined each of those to 8 bits. So it was like a decision on their part. So that's why the IP address or each of those octets is confined to 0 to 255. So it was a design decision on, you know, on that form of IP address. Like they could have chosen to use 16 bits per letter, and then that would be, you know, bigger and represent more. Sorry for the confusion. Other questions?
Or bit or byte? Each letter is a byte or a bit?
Each letter is 8 bits, which is 1 byte.
Okay.
Yes.
And
yes, and a nibble is 4. Nibble is 4 bits. Get it, guys? Byte? Nibble? Mouse? Nibbling a cracker? I think that's what they had in mind. Computer science people. Other questions? 56. Well, the reason they wrote down the zeros, if we look on the answer here, there's a whole bunch of zeros, is they asked for a 32-bit binary value. So you'd have to, you know, each of those 32, you would need a number. So since the number 90,210 only takes up, say, that much space, you still need a number for the rest of your 32 bits. So, I mean, it seems like a picky thing, but, I mean, you have 32 bits, you should explicitly say that, oh yeah, the rest of these bits are zeros, you know, don't count them, or whatever. Yay! Other questions? No? Jokes? Stories? Adventures? Nervousness? Anxiety? Okay, well, I guess if you guys don't have anything else, then good luck! You guys can do it! Make me proud! Draw that easy button. Yay, thanks for coming.